Hey folks, this is Kevin. On this week's episode of Risk, you'll hear Akasha Atherton.
When I got home from rehab, I actually cranked my vibrator to settings I had never even bothered with before.
That and more. But first, listen, if you were interested in that trip to Portugal we've been planning for Risk fans, stay tuned, because so many of you said it would be more convenient for you if the trip took place in 2025, so you had a little more time to plan, and if it was a little more affordable. So we are in the process of recreating that Portugal vacation to take place in the spring of 2025, and to be more affordable. You can always email me with any questions at kevin@risk-show.com, and you can find out a lot more about it at risk-show.com/Portugal.
We'll be right back.
Now here's the show. Hello, folks. This is Risk, the show where people tell true stories they never thought they'd dare to share. I'm Kevin Allison. This is the Beatles behind me now. And we're calling this week's episode Getting Better. You know, in one way or another, or many ways, you are getting better, my friend. I know it. I know it. Now, in a little bit, we're going to hear from Gabriella Ponce. But before that, a story from Akasha Atherton. You know, when we told Akasha we were running her story this week, she wrote back something really beautiful. She said, "I tell this story because 2 years ago, I would have given anything to hear it from someone else. My hope is that this reaches someone who needs it as much as I did. I am admittedly terrified to put such a vulnerable chunk of information about myself out into the public sphere, and I seriously considered using a pseudonym, but every time I try to hide from the world or mute myself to blend in with it, I end up drunk. I don't want to do that anymore. Thank you for helping me take a risk and try doing something different this time." Hell yeah! Let's hear it for Akasha, and let's hear from Akasha Atherton. Here she is now with a story we call Back in My Body.
Getting so much better all the time. It's getting better all the time.
How did I get here? That was the one clear thought in my aching head as I came to from yet another alcohol-induced blackout. At least I was in my own bed, but then I looked over and saw my partner, Isaac, hovering nearby. And that's when bits of the previous day came flooding back, and the nausea kicked in full force. He'd come home from work to find me completely incoherent before 6 p.m., and he called me out on it. After that, all I remember is crying and confessing. I knew early in adulthood that I had a problem with alcohol. It wasn't long after I turned 21 that I stopped drinking because I liked it, and I started drinking because I did not like myself. But in my mid-20s, I managed to quit, and that is when I started dating Isaac. And we got a few good years in where he never saw me drink. And when the pandemic rolled around, he didn't really think much of it when I started having a beer with him every now and then. But that beer, every now and then, very quickly turned into stashing liquor bottles around the house and taking a swig whenever I thought I could get away with it, which was all day, every day. And by the time this day of reckoning came around, I'd been trying to hide that hard drinking for the better part of 2 years. So, on this awful morning, shaking in bed, unable to meet his eyes, he used a very scary, calm voice to ask, "Are you sober enough to really hear what I am saying?" I managed to squeak out a very feeble yes, and he proceeded to tell me in no uncertain terms that I needed to get help or I needed to get out. A couple days later, I slunk into an assessment for substance use disorder where a professional told me in no uncertain terms that I needed to get help or I probably would not get out alive. One excruciating week later, I checked myself in for 28 days at rehab. Now, simply getting into and even completing treatment was hardly a guarantee that my relationship would survive. I spent most, if not every day that I was there, convinced it was entirely possible I would not be welcome back at home when I got out. Fortunately, he did give me that second chance, but it did come with conditions. Like, we were going to need an equitable division of the household chores and finances. And for a while, he was going to want to see my monthly bank statements because he did not know if he could trust or rely on me, and I could not blame him. It actually felt really nice to have these immediate, tangible things that I could do to work on building that trust back. And that's especially because there was one major hurdle on the track back to intimacy that I could not seem to clear. Simply put, he wanted me to put out, and I could not get aroused if my life depended on it. At the risk of humble bragging, that man has never been able to keep his hands off of me, which is a great problem to have most of the time. Isaac was the first sexual partner I trusted enough to ask for what I want, and the first person I really believed when he called my naked body beautiful. But when I was drinking, I was usually too tired or distracted or sick to pay him enough attention. And now that I was quote-unquote better, he wanted me to pay him a lot of attention. But unfortunately, when I got sober, my libido just disappeared. And when I say my libido disappeared, I mean completely gone, absolutely non-existent. When I got home from rehab, I actually cranked my vibrator to settings I had never even bothered with before in the hopes that something would happen, and I got absolutely nothing. Which was weird, because I didn't really get the hang of masturbating until my early 20s, so I've been feverishly making up for lost time ever since, and it was startling and upsetting to find the urge was now entirely absent. And even though I knew it's common in early sobriety for libido levels to drop, this complete loss was an unexpected grief. And my frustration was compounded by the fact that I couldn't get anyone to talk with me about it, like medical professional or otherwise. Because most of the conversation about sex and early recovery is really focused on not jumping into new relationships and accidentally replacing your addiction with a person. But there's not a lot said about what to do if you are already in a sexual relationship that you would like to keep and now requires all of this repair. I could get very few people willing to share the wisdom of their experience on that with me. And I was getting all this support in other areas, but on this one little detail, the silence was leaving me feeling isolation and shame and helplessness and all of those ugly feelings that kept me drunk for so long. I did not know what else to do, so I usually just faked enthusiasm for sex. But that never really worked because Isaac could always tell, and then he would feel like he was forcing me to perform a chore, and that would just kill whatever mood there was. So at some point, desperate to do more than phone in a performance, and truly terrified I was gonna lose him at some point if I kept failing to meet his needs, I decided to fulfill a request of his that I had avoided for years. The room felt familiar enough, brightly lit, seemingly sterile, nondescript pop songs pumping through the speakers. A soft-spoken, licensed practitioner wearing gray scrubs came in and instructed me to strip from the waist down and lay on the table. And up to that point, it could have been a medical appointment. But rather than put my feet in the stirrups, she instructed me to press my heels together. Which did make sense, considering she needed access to apply hot wax between my thighs and rip out a virgin forest of pubic hair. It was easily some of the most physical pain I ever voluntarily endured, and the thought occurred that this was right. It was only appropriate that I go through some of the agony I'd put Isaac through. Same thought had actually occurred when I was shaking through withdrawal seizures on our bathroom floor earlier on, but this time my pain was a conscious peace offering as opposed to an inevitable consequence. And all of this seemed fitting because a large part of recovery from substance use disorder is focused on making amends to those we harmed, which is usually a pretty straightforward process. Brutal, but straightforward. But like I said, there's not a lot in the book about sexual reparations. So I was making that playbook up as I went along, and this was my Hail Mary wax. The rest of that day was spent moving around as little as possible and anxiously waiting for Isaac to get home. I did not doubt that he would be thrilled, but I doubted very much if I would be. Still, I had already paid a stranger to torture me, so I would be damned if I was not going to try to get something out of it. Before he even touched me, the whole ordeal was worth it. For the second time that day, I was naked from the waist down, but now a beautiful man who I love so much was staring at me with lust and reverence. An exquisite ache crept up my thighs, and a slight shift of stance rubbed my freshly smoothed skin together, and a sharp shock of arousal ricocheted around my entire body, and my fingers tingled, and my nipples hardened, and I could not recall the last time I had been so wet. When he finally crossed the room to kiss me, I was already halfway to an orgasm. And oh, there were so many that night. My first sober orgasms in years, and arguably some of the best ever. And the experience brought me back into my body in a way I hadn't felt in a long time. and it cracked open a door in our relationship I truly had not been convinced was going to open again. That was about a year and a half ago. The reality is that one grand gesture or night of passion does not a relationship repair. But it was a beginning, and we're getting closer to that deeper and more meaningful relationship, one day at a time. Every day is a chance for me to choose myself and to choose us over my disease. And I am so grateful that Isaac continues choosing me and choosing us too. I recently celebrated a year of sobriety. Though my sex drive is not where I would like it to be, I have learned that when I remain willing and open in mind and body, workarounds are possible. And just as importantly, I know that when I stop worrying about who and where I'm not, I'm actually pretty happy right here, bare and exposed, with nothing to hide.
Are you obsessed with the Golden Girls?
If you are, you have to check out our new podcast, The Golden Girls Deep Dive Podcast.
I'm Patrick.
I'm Jen.
Each week, we recap an episode of everyone's favorite sitcom, The Golden Girls.
Then at the end of our podcast episodes, we'll do a deep dive into something from the Golden Girls universe.
Like that rumored on-set feud between Betty White and Bea Arthur.
So grab your cheesecake and head out to the lanai as you subscribe to your new favorite podcast,
The Golden Girls Deep Dive Podcast.
Listen to and follow The Golden Girls Deep Dive Podcast on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Risk. This is True Love's Behind Me Now, and we just heard from Akasha Atherton. Folks, one of our Patreon patrons, Jeanette LeBlanc, recently sent us this note with their donation. Jeanette said, "I am inspired by everyone on this team. I have inhaled episode after episode, sometimes brought to my knees by the intensity and the vulnerability of the stories. It's a big hit to my current budget, but I need the connection. It's an investment in my mental health." Wow. We are so, so grateful, Jeanette. That is truly beautiful, an honor to hear. And folks, I will be uploading a new check-in to Patreon about all the work on my mental health I've been doing this summer and how I'm about to embark on a new adventure. I'm going away for 3 weeks to do something called Trance Camp. It's an intensive in hypnosis for self-exploration all around the theme of the hero's journey in the great myths and other stories. So, if you're a member on Patreon, don't miss that. And if you're not, become a member. And if you are a member and you can increase your donation, increase it. Or if you want to make a one-time donation, that's at paypal.me/riskshow. We really, really, really... We really, really, really do need your help. Okay, folks, next up, we're going to hear from Gabriella Ponce with a story she told at our New York show last January. This story touches on the subject of an eating disorder at one point. Here is Gabriella Ponce now with a story we call Role Model.
I've been living with an eating disorder since I was 16 years old. That means that it's always really hard to feed myself. Whether I'm eating too much or too little, it's always been an issue. What has never been an issue is feeding other people. I'm that person that's like, you want more food? I'll get you that. You don't like it? Don't eat it. No big deal. Years ago, when I was in group therapy, one of my friends shared that she was really struggling with feeding her son. She said, guys, it's really, really hard to feed your child when you've got an eating disorder. And I was like, why? Just give him food. It was almost 10 years later that I began to understand what she was talking about. When my husband and I decided to start a family, my eating disorder had been in remission for almost a decade. Sure, it knocked on my door every now and again, like when that toxic ex texts you at 3 o'clock in the morning, you know better than to answer. I knew better than to fall into the eating disorder. Again, I was in a really healthy relationship with food. I was feeling strong. I was feeling confident. So why not, right? Why not start a family? If you ask anybody, my pregnancy was amazing. My doctors were really proud of me. I was healthy. I looked great. I exercised right up until the day before I gave birth. If you ask me, my pregnancy was really, really, really awful. Waking up every morning to a growing body that I couldn't control was my worst nightmare. Every week was harder than the previous, but I made it through, and at 39 weeks, I had my baby girl. Thank you. Labor was really, really, really hard. Labor was so hard that I lost my voice, actually. When I was in the hospital room, the nurses brought me my baby. She had the hiccups, and I held her against my chest. Our first family video is of me speaking into the camera, and since I lost my voice, I sounded like Darth Vader. And I'm saying, this is our family. And then she's got the hiccups in the back, and she's just like, And it's a really beautiful moment, and it was perfect, and I was madly in love, and I was terrified. I was scared shitless that I was going to fuck her up, you know, because they're like born with such a clean slate. But also I was really, really excited that I was going to take back control of my body. I had decided to breastfeed, not because of the bond, not because of the health benefits. My mom had told me that breastfeeding burns more calories than exercise, and I was like, yes, sign me up. I was going to turn breastfeeding into an Olympic sport, and I was going to breastfeed my ass off. Then the nurse told me that newborns' stomachs are like the size of a tablespoon, and so that wasn't going to work for me. So what I did was I hopped on Amazon Prime, thank you, and I bought a hand pump. And so what I started doing was I would feed my baby, and then I'd supplement with pumping because I really, really wanted to breastfeed my ass off. I felt great. It was awesome. I was doing really well. I was producing milk, which is hard for certain women. And it was like, this is a very virtuous thing to do, right? Like, make a lot of milk was a really good thing. So I started getting really into it. I'd feed my baby and then I'd like pump. And I was like, oh, there's half an ounce. Maybe I can get to an ounce. Then I was like, oh, it's a full ounce. Maybe I can get to two. What breastfeeding did was it threw me back into the world of measurements and numbers. When I was an anorexic, every pound lost was a win, right? It gave me a sense of worth and a sense of value. As a breastfeeding mother, every ounce pumped was making me feel like such a winner. So I was feeling great. One day it was time for me to feed my baby, and she was crying, and I picked her up. But I'd been pumping so much that my body was producing an enormous amount of milk, more milk than she needed. So my breasts were like massive and hard as rocks. And they were like this purple, greenish, veiny, like gross thing. And she couldn't latch on. And she was crying and I couldn't feed her. And it was like trying to bite into like a watermelon. Like you can't. And I was like, holy fuck, I'm such an asshole. Because I've put my needs before my babies, and I can't feed her. And I know addiction, I know how it sneaks in, so that was a big red flag. And I was like, you know what? I think I need to go back. I think I need to focus on feeding my child. So I did. I spent the next months of our breastfeeding journey just really focusing on feeding her. And I weaned myself off the pumping. And we did great. We were doing good. And then we finished the breastfeeding chapter. And then I was so excited to get my body back. It was going to be mine. And I was also really excited. We were moving into solids. I was excited because I was going to make all this baby food from scratch. And I was going to put into practice everything that my nutritionists had taught me about a good balanced diet. And like I was going to expose my baby's palate to these wonderful foods and flavors and textures and all this stuff. I was puring turkey and beets and goat cheese and sage. My kid didn't like any of it. My kid liked applesauce. So every time I tried to feed her one of my Michelin gourmet meals, she'd like turn away, spit it out. And I didn't want to fight about it, you know? So I started to feel really kind of like out of my league. So I decided to just throw my hands up. Jesus, take the wheel. I gave the kid to the nanny and I was like, please feed her. I didn't give her any instructions. I was like, at this point, I really think that anybody else knows better than I do. It was great. I didn't worry about feeding my daughter for years. I was worried about myself, which was easy, and I know how to take care of that. And I lived in bliss for a really long time. And then when she turned 6, I took her to her pediatrician for her well visit. It had been a while since we'd been to the doctor because of COVID, so it was our first time back. And there we were. My daughter sat on the butcher paper with her My Little Pony underpants. She looks so cute. The pediatrician comes over and she says, I'm sorry to tell you, your daughter's on the scale. And I was like, what scale? And then she leaned in like she was going to say something really foul. And she said, the BMI obesity scale. And my life just fucking shattered. I started to panic. I started to sweat. I got nauseous. The anorexic in me said, this is what you fucking get. You let go of control, and now your daughter's obese. This is your fault. I was so ashamed. I cried, and I told the doctor, I said, I don't know what to do. I have an eating disorder. And the doctor said, you just need to take charge of your daughter's eating. Feed her good food. And then I said, but she's a really picky eater. And the doctor said, listen, I'm going to give you some advice. You sit with her at the dinner table. Don't let her leave the table until she's had 5 bites of healthy food. So I was like, all right, control. I got this. We went home that night. I don't remember what I made for dinner. My daughter and I sat at the table. It felt like hours. First, I was like, come on, 5 bites. If you take 5 bites, I'll let you watch My Little Pony for an extra hour. Nope. Eventually, it turned into, come on. If you don't take 5 bites, you're not watching My Little Pony tonight. Didn't work either. I was so frustrated. Eventually, I just resorted to, like, scare her. You know how every parent has that thing that they do? They don't even need to say a word. They're just like, they give you the look. Mine is a sigh. I looked at her and I was like, and then she knew. And she was crying and her fists were tight. But she took 5 bites. She took 5 bites. And so she was excused and she got up and she left the table and she went to the bathroom. And I don't know what it is that made me follow her, but I did. And when I opened the door, my 6-year-old was leaning over the toilet, spitting out the food that I had forced her to eat. And I dropped to my knees. And then a different voice kicked in and said, no, this is what fucking happens when you control. That was a really big turning point in my life. I decided after that day that I'm not going to teach my daughter how to eat. I am going to teach her about self-love. I'm going to teach her to love her body. I'm going to teach her to love herself, no matter what that looks like to anybody else. And I also decided that I'm going to be really honest and transparent with her about my struggle and my journey. I'm going to teach her that loving ourselves is not easy. Some days are really hard. And on those days, we give ourselves compassion and care and patience, and we push forward. And on the days that are good, we revel in those because we feel incredible. And loving ourselves puts us on top of the world, and there's no better thing. I remember that when my husband and I got pregnant and we went to get our ultrasound, when they announced the sex of the baby, I always wanted a boy. I thought it was easier. And the technician had her hand on my belly, and she was like, "It's a girl." And I was like, "Can you check again?" And she was kind of annoyed. But just the idea of having a girl was so scary to me. Now I'm really, really grateful, and I'm really glad that I have a daughter, because every day she teaches me so many things. But I think above all, she teaches me to be the kind of role model that she needs, to be the kind of role model that other young girls also need. Thank you.
This is Risk. This is Valentine behind me now. And we just heard from Gabriela Ponce. You can find Gabriela's writing about healing at mybodymystories.com. And you can find her on Instagram at Gabriela Ponce, PH. Folks, don't forget that I do storytelling coaching. That could be for the stage, for job interviews, podcasts, business presentations, wedding toasts, eulogies, social media, you name it. I've worked with trial lawyers preparing their ending statements and preachers and tour guides. Other folks reach out to me for creative brainstorming sessions. I love that. Or a little mentoring around this or that aspect of their sexual or their gender journey. And still others reach out for official ICF style coaching. That's the International Coaching Federation. I'm getting certified from them. It's the most recognized style of coaching in the world of business and nonprofits. If you feel like you have a particular problem and would like someone to hold space for you and ask questions to help you think and feel your way through it, maybe more thoroughly, more clearly, more exactly than you ever have before. I also do hypnotherapy style guided meditations for people. So just write to me at kevin@risk-show.com and let's figure out what's right for you.
We'll be right back. We're back.
Folks, our next episode is another one of those conversations I have where someone shares a story with me. This one is about a junior high bullying incident that went way, way too far. But that's Wednesday. And folks, today's the day. Take a risk.